From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we are now just 4 days out from Election Day, and we've been focusing a lot of attention on the presidential race, but there are many key Senate and House races up for grabs on Tuesday as well, and that could have a big impact on what Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump is able to accomplish in office. Jessica Taylor is a political reporter for NPR. She joins us now. Hi, Jessica.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's start with the Senate. Where are we at this point with the Senate? Democrats had been optimistic about their chances to take back control. Is that still looking likely 4 days out?
I would say they're cautiously optimistic, but far less optimistic than even just a few days ago, I think. We're sort of finally seeing this impact of everything that's happened with Hillary, between the email new investigation and Obamacare numbers sinking. That's sort of maybe not showing up as much in the presidential race where it might matter, but in the Senate races and other down ballot races, it is. In some of these races that are just so tight, like New Hampshire, Indiana, Missouri, North Carolina, that could really sort of make a big difference. So I think Republicans, when I've talked to them this week, yesterday especially, I think they sounded the best that they have in several weeks.
But the funny thing is, it seems like there are some Senate races where people thought Democrats had the edge, and now it looks like Republicans are doing better. And in other ones, people thought the Republicans had the edge, and now not everybody is moving in the same direction, it doesn't seem like.
Yeah, the map that we thought we were going to have to begin with has completely changed. Florida and Ohio, I think, are sort of firmly in Republicans' hands at this point. And I think where the race is going to be decided is in places like Missouri, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania. And like you said, Missouri and Indiana, I think, were races we didn't think we would be talking about at all. And I think this both has to do with candidates that are there that have made different dynamics. In Missouri, certainly Roy Blunt, the incumbent, he is sort of the embodiment of Washington, a family of lobbyists. And Democrats have really effectively hit him on that. And they have a very good recruit there. And Jason Kander, he's a young military veteran, and he's sort of made this effective case that Washington sort of needs new blood. Sort of the opposite thing is happening in Indiana. Democrats got this race on the map when they convinced former Democratic Senator Evan Bayh, whose name is political gold in the Hoosier state, to get back in. And he was running against, you know, sort of an unknown congressman, Todd Young, for the open seat there. Bayh has been hit by so many things, to his residency, to how much time he spent in D.C., to his connections with lobbying firms. And, you know, he sort of started out this race with more than a double-digit advantage. That is completely evaporated, and Republicans really feel like they have the momentum there right now.
Well, let's listen to a little bit from the debate there in Indiana with Evan Bayh and Todd Young. And they started talking about that issue, Bayh's lobbyist ties. Here's some from their debate.
Clearly, Congressman Young is getting pretty desperate. It's not true that I was for cap and trade. I'm against cap and trade. It's not true that I have ever been a lobbyist. It's simply not true.
And Evan Bayh casts the deciding vote for Obamacare. We would not have Obamacare, ladies and gentlemen, but for Evan Bayh's vote. With respect to being a lobbyist, okay, he's a partner at a lobbying firm. Maybe they pay him $2 million not to lobby.
Okay, so a little bit of sound there from Indiana. Let's talk about the House. What's going on with the House right now? Is it still in play or not anymore?
I don't think it was ever truly in play. Democrats need 30 seats, which doesn't sound like a lot, but there are less than 40 competitive seats right now. Remember, the House map really sort of shrunk after 2012 redistricting, when Republicans, after 2010 gains, were really able to shore up some of their seats and really reduce the number of competitive seats. So even with a presidential year, which tends to favor Democrats, they really sort of have to run the table. And there are some places that they thought really would be in their column that they're struggling right now. Upstate New York Senate races should be sort of ripe for the picking. These are even districts that President Obama carried. Places like Michigan and Iowa, where they need to do well. But, you know, these are places where Donald Trump necessarily doesn't hurt them. These are sort of wider districts, lower percentage of college educated voters. Trump isn't necessarily the drag on there that they need them to be to get to the 30. You know, I think that a couple of weeks ago, even when the presidential race was looking better for Clinton, I could have said that maybe Democrats had a possibility of picking up about 20 seats. Right now, I think that could be, you know, 12 to 15 would be a good night for them right now.
Jessica, just a few seconds left, but is there any chance that after this election, whatever happens in the House and the Senate, that gridlock goes away?
I don't think so. When you've had such a polarized election and, you know, Republicans right now, their best message is sort of this check and balance that, OK, you know, even Senate strategists and things, too, they think that, you know, the race is tightened, but they still think that Hillary Clinton is probably going to win. And they are saying, you know, elect a Republican Congress so that we can provide this check and balance on her. I think that ends up with, you know, more scrutiny, more investigations, more sort of roadblocks for a President Clinton even before she would get there.
That's Jessica Taylor, a political reporter for NPR, watching the House and the Senate for us. Jessica, thanks.
Thanks so much.
Well, Donald Trump was campaigning in Florida yesterday, as was President Obama, on behalf of Hillary Clinton. Trump's former rival, Marco Rubio, is trying to hold on to his Senate seat in that state. And there's another tight race in Florida's 26th congressional district, where Republican incumbent Congressman Carlos Curbelo is trying to win his second term. He's facing the Democrat Joe Garcia. Patricia Mazzei is political writer for the Miami Herald, and she joins us from Miami for this week's district profile. And we want to start by setting the stage, Patty. Like Rubio, Carlos Curbelo was born in Miami to Cuban exiles. Rubio's parents left before Castro's rise. Curbelo's fled Castro in the 60s. And unlike Rubio, Curbelo says he will not vote for Donald Trump. How's that impacting this race?
Curbelo was an early Trump rejector on the Republican side. And you would think that maybe that has taken Trump off the table in the campaign, but it hasn't, because Democrats have made a point of trying to tie every incumbent Republican to Trump. And so Curbelo has gotten to the point where he has a TV ad running where he explicitly rejects both Clinton and Trump. So he is basically running against his party's own nominee at this point.
Is that hurting him?
We don't know, because there has not been a lot of public polling in the race. I think people have shown a willingness in South Florida to split the ticket, but this is a very tight district. It has swung from Republican to Democrat to Republican since 2010, and presidential years tend to favor Democrats.
Well, here's another ad from Congressman Curbelo. This was released in September, shows him fishing with one of his daughters.
Growing up in Florida, some of your greatest memories are fishing with Dad or collecting shells with Mom. A hobby for some, a livelihood for others.
This can't be taken away from us. I'm Carlos Curbelo. I've worked with both parties to protect the Everglades. I battled lobbyists to protect the Keys from oil spills.
You know, what is the question he has about Donald Trump? He's sitting there with his daughter fishing. What is his protest of Trump?
I mean, he was the guy who posited that Trump could be a plant for the Democrats early on in the Republican primary. He just says that he's erratic and can't be trusted. Mm. Curbelo has run as a moderate ever since this seat was redrawn to favor the Democrats. And in kind of centrist South Florida, it is difficult to find an elected Republican who is willing to be a Trump fan. There are some, but he is not the only local member of Congress who has rejected Trump.
Yeah. Well, let's take a look at the Democrat, Joe Garcia. He represented the district in 2012, but as you said, lost re-election to Curbelo 2 years ago. Here's an ad from his campaign from early June. He referred to his time representing this district 2 years ago.
We need to make sure we raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. We need to grow the middle class. It's an essential part of who we are and what we are as a country. One of the things that we tried to do when we were in Washington is make sure that you knew exactly where I stood on issues of importance. Whether it be a woman's right to choose, healthcare, and fighting Republican attempts to take it away, whether it be the issue of immigration reform, each and every one of these things were essential to the future of our community.
So that's the Democrat Joe Garcia, also born in Miami, also two Cuban immigrant parents. But unlike his opponent, Curbelo, he does support his party's standard bearer, Hillary Clinton. How does that impact him?
Well, when Clinton has campaigned lately in South Florida, when President Obama campaigned for her yesterday, they have mentioned Joe Garcia. Joe Garcia has gotten a speaking role at these rallies. He's trying to benefit off of the coattail effect here, where every time there's a big name surrogate or the candidate herself in town, he can win maybe a few votes and a little bit media while they're here.
Big controversy, though, in his campaign. His former chief of staff, Jeffrey Garcia, no relation, served time in jail for an illegal scheme to request mail ballots online on behalf of unsuspecting voters. Now, no ballots were sent, but again, this was the candidate Joe Garcia's chief of staff. How's that hurting the candidate?
Well, Joe Garcia was never charged with any wrongdoing, but it was largely what fueled his loss 2 years ago. I mean, it was a campaign based on character issues. And Curbelo is running from a similar stance now. He's saying, I don't have this blemish on my record. And if we're both moderates, then you should pick me.
Yeah. Again, both candidates in this congressional district were born to Cuban parents. What role has Cuba and President Obama's move to improve relations with the country played in this congressional race?
Cuba has been a key difference in the race. Curbelo opposes Obama's policy, generally speaking. Garcia supports it. And they really have delved into the details. I mean, it's not just whether we should have relations with the Cuban government, but Curbelo thinks that the U.S. should curtail federal benefits that are given automatically to Cubans because they're giving refugee status when they arrive in the United States. And Garcia says, no way, you shouldn't close the door to the same people who, your countrymen, essentially. You should not try to take away the benefits that your family and my family benefited from. So Cuba is certainly a sore spot.
Pivotal topic in the election there. Patricia Mazzei, political writer for the Miami Herald, checking in on Florida's 26th congressional district in this week's District Profile. Patty, thank you.
My pleasure.
And to Syria now, where 250,000 people remain trapped in the besieged city of Aleppo. There's supposed to be a ceasefire today to allow civilians and the rebels opposed to President Assad to leave. But as we've seen in the past, ceasefires don't work. Russia, which backs Assad, says this is the last chance for the rebels to leave safely, but they've rejected the offer and continue to fight. About 250,000 people are trapped in the city. They don't have enough food or water. There's also been a shortage of medicine. The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones was in Aleppo yesterday and joins us today from Damascus. Owen, we've heard reports from inside Aleppo of a city just destroyed. What do you see?
The city is in a terrible state. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Now, the east has taken the brunt of it, and that's because it's had airstrikes. But the west, too, has been through years of war, and you can see it. I mean, you go to the old market, lies in ruins, and it was taken by the government 4 years ago, but the area around it is still so heavily contested. And as you walk through the market, you know, the Syrian army people are saying, be careful here and there, because there are snipers from the other side just a few hundred meters away. That means they've been unable to clear it up. The building is now home basically to a few cats who are picking their way around the spent ammunition, the rubbish, the detritus of war. And that's all that's left.
You're saying it's this famous market is now home to a few stray cats. Well, when you were in Aleppo, you went to a Catholic church, spoke with a priest there. He said the church had been attacked by forces opposed to President Assad. Let's listen.
So what is your name, sir?
I am Reverend Ibrahim Ansir.
Thanks for talking to me. And what are you showing me now?
It is where the rocket came over the church.
So this is a rocket from eastern Aleppo?
Yes, from the eastern Aleppo. Which is not far away from here, 300 meters.
So that's where the rebels are in eastern Aleppo?
Yeah. I don't like the word rebels. I don't think they are rebels. They are terrorists.
And why do you think they're attacking you?
They are attacking us because they don't want Christians in this country.
How many Christians have actually left Aleppo?
75% of the Christians have left legally or illegally. They wanted us far away from this country. We lived in this country for long, long decades peacefully. Yes.
And how many did you originally have in your community?
I had 500 families.
Right. And so now you've got how many families?
I only have now 140 members.
Are you still running services?
Yes. I have worship services every Sunday morning, and I have at the same time meeting for university students.
Now, you describe the people on the other side of the line, as it were, in eastern Aleppo as terrorists.
Yes.
But there are many civilians there as well, aren't there?
I know there are civilians. We have no problem with civilians, but they are trying to establish Islamic state, which is far away of any kind of civilization.
What do you think is the future of the Christians in Aleppo?
The Christians are called the salt of the world, according to the teaching of Jesus Christ, our Lord. We are called to carry the cross, and we are carrying the cross of this country. But what really makes us feel shock is the position of countries that they think that they are supporting freedom and they are supporting democracy, while in fact we are experiencing all kind of vulgar behavior of some people who have only the shape of a human beings.
Owen, do you know what is true here? Is it the citizens of Syria who want to overthrow Assad who are attacking the Catholic Church and the Christians? Is it ISIS? Do we know who's attacking in Aleppo?
Okay, so there are just two versions. I think that's the way to look at it. Here's the government version. The government version is that there are ISIS and Al-Qaeda and other violent jihadist groups who have got control of eastern Aleppo, and the government would say there are virtually no, in fact they would say there are no, pro-democracy fighters left in eastern Aleppo. So they're just up against people who want to establish an Islamic state. And they produce evidence like yesterday, those people sent three suicide trucks into western Aleppo. So that's the government version. The opposition version is that the government is a repressive and brutal regime that tortures people, has done for decades, and will continue to do so. And they simply can't trust it. And it is using very tough tactics, these airstrikes, barrel bombs, and torture. And that if they left eastern Aleppo, then the army will just pick them up and they detained, tortured, and possibly worse. So those are the two versions, and quite simply, they are different ways of looking at it.
Yeah, and we have heard that the rebels don't want to take advantage of a ceasefire, for instance, and leave because they're afraid as soon as they do, they'll be, as you say, detained by government forces. But I mentioned ISIS. Is ISIS a presence in Aleppo?
The main group there is the Nusra Front, al-Nusra. So technically, it did disassociate itself from al-Qaeda not long ago, but did so with an al-Qaeda sort of representative at the news conference. So it was like it was a friendly divorce. So that is the group that's dominant in eastern Aleppo. But Islamic State, of course, are present in other parts of the country and very strong, and they control Raqqa still. And you just have to understand how complex this is. You've got the government saying that there are people from 85 different countries now fighting on Syrian soil. And if you look at governments, the United States, Russia, Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and many others are getting involved. And that's why it's so difficult to resolve.
The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones speaking with us from Damascus. He was in Aleppo yesterday. Owen, thanks as always for your reporting.
Thanks very much.
Well, the federal government owns about 28% of the country's landmass. In the West, that number is nearly 50%. And in states like Oregon, Utah, and Nevada, it's even more. It's land that makes up national parks, forests, monuments, and wildlife refuges. But it's also leased for grazing livestock and extracting timber and oil. So what would it mean if the federal government did what many critics have been asking for and transferred those lands to states? The Northwest News Network's Emily Schwing reports.
Shortly after a jury acquitted seven defendants of conspiracy in the occupation of Oregon's Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, defendant Shauna Cox told Oregon Public Broadcasting the group's legal fight over federal lands isn't over.
We have a lawsuit against the federal government to prove that that land does not belong to the federal government. It actually belongs to the citizens of Harney County. That's a state issue. That has not anything to do with the federal.
They own a third of America. And that's just too damn much land to manage efficiently and effectively.
That's Congressman Rob Bishop, a Republican from Utah. He chairs the House Natural Resources Committee. Bishop argues the federal government is neither a worthy steward nor an ideal landlord.
And that's why if you can chop it up into smaller areas and allow states and counties who do have the expertise and are there on the ground to make that determination, it can be much, much better.
Bishop was recently in Wenatchee alongside Washington Republican Congressman Dan Newhouse. Ranchers, horsemen, members of the NRA, about 100 people came to talk about federal land management and options to transfer ownership. U.S. Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell says congressmen like Newhouse and Bishop haven't accounted for the costs associated with federal lands.
And they are not inexpensive to manage, and state budgets are not robust, that to suggest that states could do a better job of managing them is not an appropriate argument.
Washington's Public Lands Commissioner, Democrat Peter Goldmark, agrees the cost of managing federal land would become a burden on states.
Clearly, the federal government has the ability to spend the money in this regard, but Congress haven't chosen to direct any significant amount of revenue to really address the forest health problem here in the western part of the United States.
problems like insects and disease and other things that make forests vulnerable to wildfire. The state of the Northwest's forests came up during a debate between Oregon's incumbent Governor Kate Brown and challenger Bud Pierce. Brown told the audience she's found an option that doesn't involve transferring ownership.
So most recently I signed what's called a good neighbor agreement with the Forest Service that we will work collaboratively to do the thinning and fire prevention work that needs to happen on our federal lands. It's a win because it puts Oregonians back to work in our woods, and it also creates healthy forests.
In order to transfer public lands in the West into state ownership, it would likely take an act of Congress. State elected officials like Governor Brown and Commissioner Goldmark believe it's unlikely. A report this year from attorneys general from 10 Western states casts further doubt about whether a change in ownership even has legal precedent. This summer, the group adopted a two-year analysis of numerous past court cases. Only Nevada's attorney general dissented. Peter Goldmark calls that very affirming.
That's a big vote of confidence to the premise that the federal land is held in trust for the people of the country.
But Goldmark isn't seeking re-election this year, and there's turnover at other levels in land management. Secretary Sally Jewell will oversee the country's five land management agencies only until the end of the year. She says, much like America's political landscape, the fate of its lands, were they to be transferred to states, is unclear.
It's more likely that they would be sold to the highest bidder and no longer belong to the American people.
But land transfer supporters say those lands could be better managed at the local level. It's a conversation that's likely to continue even beyond November 8th. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Schwing.
Back in 2013, the city of Tacoma Park, Maryland, started something of a youth vote revolution when it allowed 16 and 17-year-olds to cast ballots in local elections. Last year, Hyattsville, Maryland, followed suit, and now a proposition would bring San Francisco into the fold. Advocates say it starts good civic habits early. Opponents say it's a ploy to skew the electorate with more liberal voters. Sam Harnett from Here and Now contributor KQED reports.
If you want an adult take on letting 16 and 17-year-olds vote, skip the adults. Listen to Lindsay Schlax's social studies class.
We're going to do a discussion in class regarding whether or not...
The class here at Ruth Asawa San Francisco School of the Arts is divided on the issue. Some students have jobs, and they believe that should give them the right to vote. Others say kids would be too easily swayed by their parents or Facebook feeds. Student Sam Trevers... He says San Francisco would be a great test case for youth voting.
Because I think that the youth are very educated and active in politics and social issues.
Youth like Isaac Schott. He's toting a book of Nietzsche's philosophy, and he quotes freely from the Founding Fathers. He opposes Prop F.
Well, I think children very often overestimate their own importance and their own ability. But to the point. In Plato's Republic... One of the principal things it warns against is an excess of democracy.
Impressive argument, says Isaac's teacher, Lindsay Schlax. But she thinks Isaac's ability to reason is proof students like him are ready to vote. Especially in San Francisco, where so many young voters are transplants who came for work.
They arrive here. They don't have necessarily a huge engagement yet with the community. They don't have a history with the community. But our students do.
In San Francisco, Prop F has a lot of support, including from all the school board members. But it was high school kids like Oliver Sungi York who got the ball rolling on Prop F. He says it's really about increasing voter turnout.
The hope is that if we can get students in the habit of voting while they're embedded in their communities, they will become lifelong voters.
That logic has its skeptics, including Vanderbilt College law professor Jenny Diamond Chang. She says back in 1971, when the national voting age was dropped to 18, it only caused a brief spike in turnout. And beware, she says. Letting young people vote had unintended consequences, like providing more justification to prosecute youths like adults.
Lowering the age, voting age, arguably gives young people more representation. It also may jeopardize some of the protections they have precisely because they are young.
Cheng says in the 50s, conservatives wanted to lower the voting age to 18 because young people were conservative. Then in the 60s, it was a liberal cause. Supporters argued that if men could be sent off to fight the war in Vietnam at 18, they should have the right to vote. Today, young people still trend liberal, and critics say the real motive of Prop F is to skew the electorate.
Yes, it's very likely that there's a political agenda here.
Claremont McKenna political science professor Jack Pitney is a vocal opponent of youth voting.
My son would want to vote. He would also like ice cream for breakfast.
You can volunteer for the campaign and go door to door.
Students here in Lindsay Schlax's class want to do way more with their votes than order ice cream. Many hope Proposition F passes, but it's not up to them. They aren't old enough to cast a ballot. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Harnett in San Francisco.
In four states, voters will be weighing in on whether to raise the minimum wage: Arizona, Colorado, Maine, and Washington State. Marilyn Gewax, an NPR senior business editor, joins us now with more on this. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Jeremy.
And I guess the reason we're talking about states raising the minimum wage is because Congress sets the federal minimum wage. It's currently $7.25 an hour, and they haven't really raised it all that much over the years.
Yeah, that's right. They used to. I mean, Congress was always the key player in this. They set the national wage floor really since the 1930s, and they always had to come back and keep adjusting it because they never really built a cost of living adjuster into it. So they have to act from time to time, and they used to do that regularly, but it's become really contentious and really partisan in recent years. So with Democrats and Republicans stuck in this stalemate, it's just left the federal minimum wage at $7.25 for more than 7 years now.
So the states and local governments have jumped into this problem.
Yeah, with both feet in a lot of places. 29 states and the District of Columbia, as well as a lot of local governments, they've all increased their minimum wages within their jurisdictions. So that can make for big differences in your paycheck depending on where you live. So, for example, if you are in Minnesota, the minimum there is $9.50 under the state law. But if you put one foot over onto the other side of the border to North Dakota, you're only covered by that federal wage of $7.25. So, you know, most polls show that Americans overwhelmingly think that that $7.25 is too low. So states always try to push the states to get this onto the ballot. And when it does appear on the ballot, they pretty easily win. So that's why Democrats are so happy to be pushing this on those, especially on those two states in Arizona and Colorado. They want to try to drive up Democratic turnout, and they think they can do that with low-wage workers, especially people of Latino heritage.
So what exactly is on the ballot in Arizona and Colorado and the other states we mentioned?
Well, Arizona, Colorado, and Maine, they're all trying to push their wages up to $12 an hour by the year 2020. And in Washington state, they're really going further. They want to push it up to $13.50 by that year. But, you know, let's be fair. There are two sides to this. Business owners also say that when you do that, if you push wages that high, they'll have to lay off workers. They won't be able to hire as many people. So while the fight for a higher minimum wage tends to help Democrats by getting out more low-wage workers, the fight against those wage increases can help Republicans, especially when they want to raise money from small business owners. Retailers, restaurant owners are especially agitated about this. So, you know, what I've just described there kind of tells you a lot about what happens in Congress. Why don't they build in that wage, inflation adjuster? Because actually, these battles can be important to them politically. Hmm. Each side sees some advantage. You know, the Democrats see it's these battles as a way to turn out voters.
Yeah.
Republicans see it as a way to raise money. It kind of stays like this year after year.
NPR senior business editor Marilyn Gewax. Marilyn, thanks.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, now to a couple of people who are working hard for no wages, although they just got a big prize for their inventions. Hannah Herbst and Anirudh Ganeshan were recently awarded a $5,000 Gloria Barron Prize for Young Heroes. Anirudh Ganeshan is 17 years old, senior at Clarksburg High School in Maryland, and Hannah Herbst is 16, a high school sophomore who also attends Florida Atlantic University. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much. Excited to be here.
Yeah, really excited to be here.
Well, Anirudh, let's start with you. You invented the Vax Wagon. Tell us what it is, first of all.
Yeah, so the Volkswagen is a human power refrigerator that runs on no ice and no electricity that can be used to store and transport temperature-sensitive medication and vaccines and transport them to remote locations throughout the world.
How do you run that on no ice and no electricity? How do you use it to cool?
So it works with the same technology as the refrigerator in your home, but instead of using electricity, it uses wheel power. So basically, a turning of a wheel will power the refrigeration system, which can refrigerate around 210 single-dose vaccine vials.
Hmm. And this goes back to a personal experience that you had. Tell us what happened that led you to invent this.
Yeah. I was originally born in India. And when I was an infant, my grandparents had to carry me 10 miles to a remote clinic in southern India to get me vaccinated. But when we got there, the vaccines were useless because they were just sitting on the counter and not being refrigerated. Hmm. And so my parents told this story to me over dinner one day, and I was curious to see if this is still a problem or if other people were affected by something I was also affected by. And so I just took to the internet and I did some research, and I found out that according to UNICEF, 1.5 million children die annually due to vaccine-preventable diseases.
Hmm. Well, stand by, Anirudh. I want to bring in Hannah. And Hannah, tell us what you invented.
So I invented an ocean energy probe designed to bring electricity access to my pen pal in Ethiopia. So she's living in energy poverty with very unstable access to electricity. And in seventh grade, I recognized this problem through a pamphlet that I received from the organization that put us in contact. And I became very interested in energy poverty. So I created several different iterations of this novel, portable, and cost-effective turbine to generate electricity for her and her family.
And how does it work?
So there's three different iterations. The first one is handheld, so you would hold the frame of it and then put it into the moving body of water. And it generated some electricity. However, I recognized that this wasn't really practical for her situation. So I created my second iteration, which you just tie to something stationary on the land. You can hold it or tie it to a tree, whatever doesn't move, and then it'll generate electricity by being carried in the current. And the third and final iteration is the recycled one that costs only $12 and is made from 90% economically feasible materials.
Wow. And is there anything else out there that's already doing something like this, or is this a first?
Well, this prototype is very novel because it's portable. Most of the turbines available on the market are large. They take thousands of man-hours to create, and they cost thousands to millions of dollars, where mine costs less than $500 to make the second iteration. And I hope to combine materials from the third and second to make it even more cost-effective for developing nations.
So have you gotten one of the prototypes to your pen pal in Ethiopia?
No, I'm working on open sourcing my prototypes right now so that people can make them anywhere in the world, including in classrooms to promote STEM education.
Hannah, how did you get into science? Because we always hear now that there aren't enough kids that are getting interested in science and math and technology. How did it happen for you?
Absolutely. So in elementary school, I really wasn't interested in science at all. I was very into theater and sports. Those were just what I enjoyed. And in seventh grade, my parents put me into this summer engineering and technology camp at Florida Atlantic University, where I'm dual enrolled now. And at first, I was kind of turned off to the whole science thing because I had been trained to just memorize, regurgitate information from a textbook onto a test. And I really wasn't doing science. But in that engineering camp, where I was the only girl in the program, I learned about how to innovate, and I created robots. And that inspired me to solve my pen pal's energy poverty problem. So that's really how I got interested in science. And as soon as I got back to school, I made sure to join a bunch of science clubs so that I could continue to hone my engineering skills that I just discovered.
What do you see yourself doing in 10 years?
I'm really not sure. I just want to do I really want to help people with whatever I end up doing in life.
And Anirudh, back to you with the same question. What got you into science?
So especially when I was a kid, I really liked playing with Legos, and that really got me into the whole innovative part of engineering. And when I was in high school, I realized that science can just do more than hone my own personal skills, but it can help others as well, such as cancer research, what I'm actually currently doing, and what I'm working with Volkswagen. And I realized that using science, you could also promote STEM education and help people and save lives. And so that's really what motivated me to get into science.
And what do you see yourself doing in 10 years?
I really want to become a social entrepreneur, basically somebody who invests and creates business ventures that will save lives and help people who are less fortunate than we are. Basically, continue the same work I kind of do with Volkswagen, but on a much larger scale.
That's Anirudh Ganesan and Hannah Herbst, two young scientists who have done some incredible inventions. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was an honor.
Thank you so much.
And in addition to the Gloria Barron Prize, Anirudh just won a $25,000 Davidson Fellows Scholarship. And last year, Hannah was 3M's America's Top Young Scientist. No surprise on either of those. You can see photos of Anirudh and Hannah and their inventions at our website, hereandnow.org.
Next week, we'll hopefully find out who wins the presidency. But this election season has been about much more than the political race. There's the ratings race. CNN, Fox News, late night TV have all been covering it. But who won and who lost there? Let's bring in NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Talk about this election on television. You know, the first thing we think of is CNN, ratings way up. But then, of course, there's risk there. They got into hot water when they had to let go commentator Donna Brazile, the Democrat who email showed sent some questions, debate questions to Hillary Clinton's camp. Are they a winner or a loser this year?
Yes. In my list, they're both. On the one hand, they've seen increased viewership. And their strategy under Jeff Zucker, their most recent sort of head of news, has always been to compete with Fox News amongst the viewers that advertisers really like, age 25 to 54, and they've really made inroads in that group. But I list them as a loser because to get that kind of achievement, they seem to have compromised some things. Indeed, Donna Brazile, a longtime analyst on CNN, also a major figure in the Democratic Party, making it look as if she was acting as a mole, giving Hillary Clinton advance notice. And it raised this question of, are they opening themselves up? Is there, is their material likely to wind up in the wrong hands? And it also raised questions about what do they get? Do they get access to the candidate, access to the campaign? Do they get extra consideration when it comes to figuring out who's going to host a town hall meeting or who's going to host a debate? These are all questions that sort of nip at CNN's credibility, and I think it's hit them really hard this year.
Yeah. I will say, though, just in passing, going to the conventions and seeing these people in action, man, you've got reporters like Dana Bash, Anderson Cooper, a lot of the commentators have been working their butts off to try to come right down the middle.
They have been working hard, but unfortunately, they are kneecapped in a way. They're undercut when executives and superiors make hiring decisions, like, for example, hiring Corey Lewandowski, who was a campaign manager for Donald Trump, was still getting severance and being paid by his campaign, and according to some reports, was still involved in planning strategy. I don't think it's that hard for CNN to say, look, if you're actively involved with a campaign, we're not going to pay you money to come and tell us,
right,
you know, about that campaign.
Because that's what spokespeople do. let's talk late night hosts and one you think is a winner. Here's Samantha Bee. She interviewed President Obama earlier this week.
After you leave office, have you thought of just whispering in Donald Trump's ear, you were right, I wasn't born here, just to, like, mess with him?
I think it's fair to say that I will be organizing my post-presidency where I'm not close enough to him to whisper in his ear.
That is very fair.
Eric, your thoughts?
So I listed Bee also among my winners because she's been the successor of Jon Stewart, not the guy who's actually hosting The Daily Show after him, Trevor Noah. She has channeled his sort of righteous indignation and also his way of digging deeply into subjects, and it's elevated her show and made her one of the real contenders in terms of satirists talking about this election.
We have to mention Saturday Night Live. Now, they gave Donald Trump a hosting gig during primary season. Let's listen.
I don't hold grudges against anybody like Rosie O'Donnell. She said some things about me that were hurtful and untrue. I said some things about her that were mean but completely accurate.
Now, Eric Deggans, at the time, You were, you know, you questioned SNL even giving him that slot, but you have them in the win column.
I have them in the win column in the sense that they have seen rating success and they have kind of manipulated the impact of Donald Trump on the media. They featured him as a guest host in the primary process when they could sort of shrug off the impact of elevating one candidate over another because there were so many candidates. And they saw a really nice ratings bump for them. And then when we got down to the general election and just two candidates, they had Alec Baldwin come on the show and develop this devastating parody impression of Trump that would allow them to sort of target his weaknesses and criticize him with their humor. So I think we have a clip of him playing Trump in the third debate. Let's check it out.
And Iran's going to write us a letter of, listen, where Aleppo isn't a disaster, and Iran is Iraq, and with Mosul is ISIS.
Mr. Trump, we have to move on.
Oh, thank God.
So briefly, Eric Deggans, you put Fox News and NBC News in the loss column. Why?
Well, Fox News lost its founder and CEO, Roger Ailes, in the middle of a sexual harassment scandal this year. And NBC News was hurt because its many different conflicts and connections made it tough for it to cover, for example, this clip from Access Hollywood that made Donald Trump look bad. Access Hollywood is an NBC-owned show, found the clip, but they couldn't get a story on air before the Washington Post. They got scooped by the Washington Post, and there's some sense that their conflicts made it tough for them, including the fact that Donald Trump first became a huge media star by hosting an NBC show called The Apprentice.
NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans. It all comes around. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.